Hello, this is Tannis from Inner Circle Sanctuary, our mother coven here in Las Vegas, Nevada, and it is my great fortune to be speaking today with Matthew Wheelton, one of the smartest and nicest men I know, and we are going to talk all things Egypt today and Egyptian paganism. And Matthew Wheelton, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, except for I have a slight scratchy throat. So if I cough a little bit, clear my throat a little bit, I apologize in advance.
Well,
but otherwise, I'm great.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. And you sound great on this end, so that's good. And how are you doing? And how is the Kemetic Temple doing in the age of COVID?
I'm doing well. It turns out I'm one of those people who is kind of happy to be a hermit. I generally have a lot of projects going and a lot of academic work, so I keep myself busy with that stuff. I'm in between semesters right now. I'll be taking another course at Berkeley. Basically Egyptian texts that are related to magic and funerary use.
Ooh, awesome.
In the upcoming semester.
Fantastic.
And the Temple of Ra itself is doing well. For those people who don't know who we are or what we are, the Temple of Ra is a polytheistic, Kemetic reconstructionist temple in San Francisco, California. It was founded by Richard Reedy, who is now deceased, and a few other people back in the 90s, with probably roots that extend further back, I'm sure. But in real terms, it happened in the 90s, middle 90s. It grew into a family of temples. There's a San Jose temple. There is a temple in Denver. There is a less active at this moment temple in Sacramento. And we are actually functioning reasonably well. The groups have always been small, and in during COVID, we have actually been exploring having rituals that are partially online, I think is the best way to say it.
Awesome.
In some ways, our rituals allow for a small set of servant priests and servant priestesses to perform the major parts of the actions, and we can on our own side altars or in our own side shrines do some of those actions sort of in tandem.
Nice.
And so it's a ritual set that involves material activity, offerings, gestures, things like that. And so we basically work that by dividing up the labor. And it's a way that we normally behave anyway when we're in person. We generally work with rotating people through all of the roles.
Very cool.
In one way or another. It might be that we work in small teams of two and pair the teams off and then swap their roles and then swap that paired team with another. Or it might be that we go through a sort of round robin. It takes, at the barest minimum, two people to do a full rite, a full, what we call a general ritual. But it works better with three specific roles, which I will say that for a moment because it's a little different than perhaps many traditions. The person who is performing the actual ritual actions with the statue, with the various offerings, with the raising and lowering of incense, will not actually be speaking.
Ah.
That person will do the actions.
Uh-huh.
Another person will be speaking the words of those actions.
Oh.
And then the third person acts a bit like a maitre d'. He or she will, or they will actually announce each action as it comes up. And that helps the ritualist know what to expect is coming. And because these rituals can be a bit complicated, they have a lot of different sections. And they can we work smoothly through the process. And if we do it that way, we'll actually rotate those three people almost like a round robin. So if you've got four people, that fourth person will get a chance to just quietly observe and participate that way. And then eventually gets to be the announcer, then gets to be the reader, then gets to be the ritual actor themselves.
Oh, that's cool.
And so this is done gender irrespectively, even though there are some specific rituals that will call for a, you know, priestess enacting the role of Isis and another as Nephthys and things like that. But we generally do not concern ourselves with gender in that in any way. And just for the audience, so that people are aware, we definitely do have people who use they, their, them pronouns.
Uh-huh.
And we are completely open to participants of all orientations and gender types.
That's awesome.
The Temple of Ra itself started out as a gay men only temple.
Uh-huh.
That's no longer true. It evolved out of that. But in the time when it was formed, which was basically in the worst moments of the AIDS crisis, it was a kind of safe space.
Sure.
For those people, and so that's the way it developed. And then over time, that has changed. And now we are open to everybody. It doesn't matter anymore.
Oh, that's great. That's such an interesting history, too.
So did I answer all of your question there?
Oh, absolutely. But it, of course, does lead to more questions. So when, as many of our conversations do, which I'm very glad to finally, be recording a conversation with you that we can share, because the ones we've had have been so fascinating. For me, to pick your brain about Egypt, Kemetic Reconstructionism, the Temple of Ra, your work and your practices. So maybe we can start with some of the terms you used in the answer, like, for example, Kemetic Reconstructionism. How would you explain that for somebody who's unfamiliar with the term?
All right. Kemetic Reconstructionism there's actually a kind of broad approach to bringing back to life the Egyptian ritual practices.
Mm-hmm.
And it can actually have more than one style. There are groups that will call that revivalism as opposed to reconstructionism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a flavor, and it's both have their validity. Both are fine. They may have different emphases. Sometimes Kemetic Reconstructionists can be focused on different time periods. There's Neos Alexandria, I think that's the name of it, which is a group of Hellenistic period Egyptian polytheists.
Wow.
So they are interested in gods and goddesses like Serapis,
uh-huh,
Zeus Amun, and there's also people who are devotees of Antinous, which is Roman period.
Right.
Not that Hellenistic period does not include Roman, it does. But the specific cult of and worship and the spread, I mean the absolute diaspora of the religion of Antinous is a Roman phenomenon. It starts in the 2nd century AD.
Right.
And then it in the time of Hadrian. And I'll let people look up that story, Antinous and Hadrian. It's very rich. It's very compelling.
Absolutely.
And so they're going to each have different sorts of focus points. Now for the Temple of Ra and the, I'll use a new term here, the Kemetic Temple Collective is a term that we've started to use for ourselves. So our little family of temples, we are calling the Kemetic Temple Collective because each of the temples has its own name. Each is different in practice, actually. We don't follow a strict, one size fits all approach, even amongst the individual temples themselves. There are differences in ritual practice between Temple of Ra, between the Kemetic Temple of San Jose, and the temple in Denver, which is called Per Achet. Now, our approach is one that looks and centers itself around the ritual texts as found on temple walls and papyri that by and large come from the New Kingdom, the 19th dynasty, 22nd dynasty, those sorts of periods. So we're talking about 1300 BCE roughly to around 1000 BCE with particular particular ritual segments actually coming from texts that are much older or much later. Sometimes they actually come from Greco-Roman temples, Dendera or Edfu. And sometimes the texts are ultimately coming from pyramid texts. And that is actually a part of the reality of Egyptian polytheism anciently, is that there is quite a lot of crossover between what one might call funerary texts, and this is the way it's often described, funerary texts versus temple texts. In many ways, that is not nearly as hard and fast a distinction than we make it out to be. For us, it seems like that's, super different. A church service for, living people is something very, very different than a church service for dead people. Or a practice for dead people. Egyptians didn't see it quite so starkly. And there are clear differences, but there are points of blending and transition actually between one and the other. So there may be a little snippet from a pyramid text that ends up being used in practically every ritual text from then on. And others that will actually, the same snippet may actually move in the funerary sphere and just get adopted by in the coffin texts in the Middle Kingdom, in the Book of the Dead, in the New Kingdom, and then may even get still picked up in the very late Roman period books of breathing and some of the other religious texts that are composed in the 2nd century AD, 3rd century AD.
Wow.
After which that starts to fade. It's a very living tradition in the sense that both anciently and now, and it's a very diverse one. It's one that changed over time. Egypt was not a monolith and it was not eternal in the sense that there was no change from period to period. There's a lot of change from period to period. New texts are constantly composed. Sometimes the new texts are composed in ways that pull together pieces from older versions, older ones, and create something entirely new out of them. It's sometimes they are paraphrases, you know, just adapting the grammar a little bit, the vocabulary a little bit.
Okay.
It was astoundingly alive. And it was astoundingly an applied art and science
mm-hmm.
to produce the rituals themselves. So they were a source of great invention and applicability to everyday life. And with that topic, we're starting to move into the world of treatments for diseases and magical practices. So let me stop there, because that kind of went on for a while.
Well, and that's fine. And we've got time to talk about all these things. And when you start talking about medical practices and magical practices, it's my understanding that they were all one, or all, you know, medical practices often involve magical or religious practices as well?
That's probably pretty fair to say. That there were some highly practical, trauma-oriented medical practices that read remarkably like modern medical practices, some of which are still done today, mm-hmm. Like how to set a dislocated jawbone. We basically do that exactly the same way it was done in the Edwin Smith surgical papyrus, which is dated, probably ultimately comes from the Middle Kingdom, but it's dated into the second intermediate period. So 1700 BCE.
That's amazing.
But at the same time, the ritual specialist would be there, or it would be the same person who would be using substances that had lots of meanings, you know, sacred meanings or magical meanings, as well as therapeutic ones. And they would be applying religious and magical texts and saying words and writing things down and things like that. There is a sort of distinction that the preponderance of more magical styles of action might be found in instances where the disease is one that doesn't have a clearly identifiable cause, something that we would think of as an infection.
Okay.
Or, you know, even a cancer, something that is, you know, it isn't obvious that the guy really has injured his foot because a rock fell on it. So there would be a distinction there. But that doesn't mean that that's, again, an exclusive thing. It's not an either or situation. And under medical practices that have a lot of mixture, most of them, by the way, do, you will almost always have a recipe that goes along with the words, and that will consist of various substances, some of which may have medical activity in our world and others which will not. Things like poisonous animal bites or stings, scorpion bites, that is basically a class of physician. And it's called the Cherepsa Serket, the controller of, you could say controller of the amulet of Serket, who is the goddess, the scorpion goddess, or Silket, either way. Or you could say the manager of scorpion protection. So it's a person who has power over the harm that a scorpion can do to you. And that would extend beyond just scorpions. And it would be in that is both prophylactic magical stuff
mm-hmm.
that prevents these things from happening, and it's treating an actual scorpion sting.
That's cool. And from what I understand, what we would understand as reality, this normal mundane life for the Egyptians, was not separated from the gods, goddesses, and spirits around them.
That's really correct. The culture was way more embedded in, first of all, its natural environment, mm-hmm. which was seen in ways that were much more alive and full of agency than the Western views hold. Partly this now will be my own interpretation. There would be certainly a lot of Egyptologists who might put nuances on what I just said there. So, So by all means, I would encourage every listener out there who hears this to try to learn more if you, and try to think about it in a way that is, has a little bit of doubt in it and critiquing in it, because we need to learn to read even Egyptologists in ways that aren't, they're the one guys who, they're the guys and the gals who know it all, because we aren't. And our field is in constant change. It's in a lot of change right now. So it is a, that embeddedness that we were just talking about refers to gods and goddesses as well. Also your ancestors, your grandparents, who are, your family would go and regularly visit the tomb and make offerings to your blessed dead. That is something that was very built into the culture. And certain of those ancestors will actually end up taking on the roles of gods. Mm. Famously, one of them is Imhotep, the architect of the first step pyramid of Necher Ikhet, and commonly known in the West as Djoser. Or Djoser, he becomes a god of medicine and healing.
Yes.
Also, there's a guy in the New Kingdom whose name is Amenhotep, son of Hapu. He also becomes deified. There's a man who was a nomarch at the end of the sixth dynasty or so in the Old Kingdom, and his name is Heka'ib, and he became a local sort of saint divinity of Elephantine area, Aswan area, at the very southern border of Egypt, and was venerated and has a whole series of shrines in one complex. In Kubbat al-Hawa, which is the west bank of Aswan. And that was in the Middle Kingdom. So his cult developed and lasted for some hundreds of years.
Wow.
The same is actually true of some kings. So veneration of an individual could start out in a sense of having an ancestor who is a good ally for you on the other side.
Yeah.
And then it could go so far as that individual gaining an entire apparatus of the functions and capabilities of a god or goddess. And in this way, Egyptian polytheism has maybe one really outstanding contemporary brother, sister, and that's Chinese Taoist celestial immortals.
Oh, okay.
Most, if not nearly all, I've been told by a Chinese person, all celestial immortals in Taoism were people.
Wow.
Many are historically known, at least in Chinese tradition. Hmm. There were generals, they were court officials, they were they were virtuous people. They were sometimes, you know, young women or even children who for some reason exemplified virtue and efficacy in a way that became recognized and celebrated and grew over time, waxed and waned over time in many cases, and has turned into the living religion of Chinese people all over Asia.
Wow.
And their diaspora as well.
Well, and it's interesting, some of the points you mentioned that involve locations, because it brings up the thought of local gods in comparison to gods that may be more universal or cosmic. So what would some, you know, as far as the, this vast pantheon of Egyptian gods, are there some you might think that might not be as exportable out of Egypt, are more tied to place in Egypt?
That's an interesting question. That's a really, really interesting question. Let me maybe kind of turn it to one side a little bit.
Okay.
Basically, every god or goddess in Egypt is associated with a particular place. They, gods and goddesses are embedded in sacred geography.
Mm-hmm.
Very important. The set of the main god or goddess in a particular temple will, this is for the temples that we have, that are mature temples that we have, you know, enough evidence. They're large enough that we can tell. Hang on. Okay, I had to turn that the phone off. There was a whole group of gods and goddesses that accompanied them. So there would be the main god or goddess, and there would be a set of deities in the shrines that would surround the main shrine, the most important shrine. Those would be called the Ennead or the Ennead, the nine. However, it doesn't mean there were exactly nine of them.
Yeah.
There might be six. There might be 15. Karnak, I believe, was 15. Karnak being a grand temple, you know, very, very important politically and religiously in certain periods. And it kind of goes more than just this being that the gods and goddesses are rooted in a place. So first of all, let me explain that that family of gods that surrounds the main god or goddess will in fact be many times deities that are coming from places that are roughly nearby. They're in the region. Their relationships as deities are directly or more or less directly to related to their a sacred geography.
Oh, wow.
Now, and there goes, there's another step to this. Many people who have studied Egypt to some extent will know of the, quote, the three major cosmogonies. So the Memphite cosmogony, the Heliopolitan cosmogony, and the Hermopolitan cosmogony.
Right.
To put those three in context, it's the Memphite is centered on Ptah as creator. The Heliopolitan is centered on Ra or Re as creator, the sun god. And then the Hermopolitan is centered around the city of Juhuti, Thoth, and involves a creation story that involves the Ogdoad, the eight.
Right.
eight ancient ones and a ninth ancient one called Kem Atef, the one who has completed his moment.
Wow.
These were water beings, snakes, frogs, eels, perhaps even.
Right.
They were the vastly fecund creatures that seem to arise directly from the waters themselves. These are, you know, the eggs of, frogs, and the Egyptians thought snakes as well. And certainly eels, would come out of the ooze, come out of the water. Mm-hmm. And they get together, and it's four males and four females.
Right.
And they get together and they create one egg that then, from which is born the sun god. Okay, so that's another creation story. So people know those three, but yeah. That is by no means all of them.
Right.
There is a Khonsu cosmogony. There is a cosmogony for Horus of Edfu, the specific form of Horus at Edfu, who is Horus Behbehti, mm-hmm. The winged sun disk.
Yes.
Then there's one for Shu, the god of the air. There's one, and that one actually includes Tefnut, most likely. They both had shrines, they both had temples. They were not just disembodied, non-cultic, non-located gods and goddesses of concepts or anything like that. So I'm trying to kind of break that concept down, yeah. That there's universal versus local. It's kind of, again, different than we might be used to thinking of it. And I've only just begun listing. There's one for Neit, the great creator goddess of Sais in the north. There's one for Shunum, the great potter creator deity of the south. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on. We don't have many of them, or we have fragments only of some of them. But there seems to have been a cosmogony, a theogony. So the origin of the universe, the origin of the gods and goddesses, and a sacred geography associated with every major temple in every region.
Wow.
None of these was hierarchically superordinate to the others.
Okay.
Though at some times, one of them may have had political power, or two, or three.
Yeah.
So, the sun god Ra-Re is important at all times, mm-hmm. and does form an organizing overarching framework, but then so does the goddess Ma'at. Mm-hmm. Who is truth, justice, order, balance, what is right, what should be. So there's just a kind of abundance of riches of viewpoints in Egyptian yeah. religion. There's no orthodoxy.
For an Egyptologist, that must be excellent because there's just so much to study. But that also is, for a practitioner of Kemetic Reconstructionism or Kemetic Paganism in general, so much to choose from, so much to find something that suits you, a god that suits you and practices that suit you.
Right. It's true. That is very true. There are many, many forms. The gods and goddesses that are the great creator gods and goddesses. Now, there is a distinction between those and some gods and goddesses who do seem to be more less popular across the country. Okay. Yeah. Great creator gods and goddesses tend to have some sort of foothold everywhere, or nearly everywhere. They really do. they're broadly cast. Mm-hmm. And that tends to be something that may have developed over time. They usually can be located in one place or one place of origin, or sometimes more than one related uh-huh. things. But they come to have a broader structural meaning, mm-hmm. And so I don't want to throw that part away. You know, I'm not trying yeah. to throw that baby out with the bathwater, because again, that's part of the diversity of it. Sure. But the great creator gods and goddesses, each, like the very mode of creation is different.
Right.
You know, Ptah creates by his heart and his tongue, his perception, his recognizing perception, his discerning perception, mm-hmm. and his naming of things. Neet creates with words. Seven words, seven phrases, or seven utterances.
And they, do you know what those are?
No, I don't actually know them. I'm sorry, I just don't have that off the top of my head. I should, I could probably investigate it for you, but sorry.
It's not lost with the words or phrases she said?
Well, that's the thing. I don't have a strong note either way in my head.
Okay.
We have a very elaborate litany of Neet that's from the Temple of Esna. Which is a late Roman, you know, second century into third century CE, so AD, mm-hmm. Temple. And the hieroglyphic texts there are some of the most difficult to read.
Really?
They are also only part of the building is preserved. It may very well be that it's in the litany or in the other parts that are found there, okay. because unfortunately Sais itself was heavily, heavily destroyed. We don't have much in the way of textual evidence from her core city, which is in the north, not in the south. So Esna is in the south. It's south of Luxor. Mm. It's not too far from Edfu. A bit north of Edfu, south of Luxor. Yeah. Let's see. I think I got that right.
One of the things I wanted to know about you personally, then too, is your background, and as much as your background as you like to talk about, like you know, growing up and everything, but then eventually. Did your love of Egypt lead you to Kemetic Temple, or did Kemetic Temple lead you to Egyptology and becoming an Egyptologist?
That's a great question. I actually started this path a long time ago. I started this when I was a teenager, young teenager. This was in the early 70s. I grew up in Chesapeake, Virginia. That's very close to Norfolk. And that's there's going to be a bearing to that in just a second. The first thing that actually attracted me to Egypt, and this is even then true in a very nascent religious sense, I think, mm-hmm. Was a book that I found on a JCPenney bookstore shelf. The JCPenneys wow. were a department store. And I was about, I think, 12.
Uh-huh.
Maybe more 13. And it was in a shopping center, and my mom shopped there all the time. And mm-hmm. I would just go gravitate over to the books section because I was a nerdy kid. and I found this book. It was by Christian de Roche-Noblecourt. Or Noblecourt, who's a great French woman Egyptologist who passed away a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was a book on Tutankhamun's tomb, you know, and I know many, many people, we get fascinated by Tutankhamun's tomb. Well, what I got fascinated with first or among the first things, was not only the art and the sort of beauty of it, but the mystery of the tomb itself. To me, it was very interesting that they would have these tombs, that they would be full of all this stuff, that they'd be right. full of all these writings on the walls. And I wanted to know the writings. And so I even then started to learn.
Wow. And
I would, sometimes my mom would, she worked in Norfolk, so she would just drop me off and in downtown Norfolk. Those were the days where that was kind of safe. Actually way safe. And I went to the Norfolk Public Library and I found my first grammar of Egyptian then.
Wow.
And so I started teaching myself Egyptian when I was like 14, 15.
Oh my gosh.
I did not get very far. The grammar they had was this very, very thin volume. It really wasn't conducive for a brand new learner who had no experience in an Afro-Asiatic language whatsoever to try to get. But what I was able to do was build flashcards, and I started learning glyphs, individual glyphs and some words.
Wow.
And that led me towards an interest in Egyptology per se. And I started university at Johns Hopkins in Egyptology.
Wow.
So I did start. It turned out to be too specialized for me at the time. It's a field where there really were no and are no jobs on earth. It's very, very, very hard to land a permanent academic position. And so many practitioners of Egyptology tend to be people who are already gentry or who don't have to worry about making a living. And that is even still true. And many people who are incredible, fabulous, unbelievably brilliant people end up not being able to support themselves.
That's a shame.
And it is a shame. It's a major shame. But but that was okay. I went on and did other things, but it was a piece that stayed with me. And I'm going to give you a different thread now.
Sure.
In Norfolk, there's a museum of art. It was called the Chrysler Museum of Art at that time. Mm-hmm. It started out as the Norfolk Museum, then it became the Chrysler because Walter P. Chrysler gifted a huge collection of stuff to that museum. His wife was from the area. She was from Tidewater, where I grew up. And they have one of those life-size or over life-size sometimes statues of Sekhmet.
Oh, wow.
That was originally made and installed in the mortuary temple of Amenhotep III.
Oh my gosh.
And there are hundreds of these. There were at least two for every day of the year. So we're talking two.
For every day of the year.
So we're talking 720 or so. 725, 730.
Oh my God.
I don't know if the five intercalary days had Sekhmets or not, because that's special. But at least for the 360, there were two. Many of them are seated, some are standing, some are over life size, some are monumental. And these got distributed in Egypt. That temple kind of was built on very shaky, wet ground. A lot of things sank underground. There were earthquakes, it fell down, the building fell down. And so they got reused in various places. Including at Karnak. So the Temple of Mut now has a number of them. Many of them are partial. But many museums around the world have these Sekhmet statues, and they're very remarkable. And that sculpture in the Chrysler Museum, I remember walking in front of it and looking at it and sort of being fixated. It was this thing, and I was like looking at it going, there's something to this. there's something more going on.
Yeah.
And it was a kind of this sense of uncanniness, and you can't see me doing this, but my head was going like a bird looks, like, you know, what am I seeing? What am I seeing? And between that and some of the Tutankhamun material, I was beginning to have a kind of more, a deeper, a more personal kind of response, a numinous response to these Egyptian things. And so I, at some point in that same period, this is before going to college, I made my first images of two gods. One was Ptah, mm-hmm. and one was Shnum. Ptah, to this day, is my primary shrine deity. And I can't exactly tell you what was the attraction, but it was there and it has been maintained. When I was a freshman in college, this would have been 1975, late or early 76, I actually reached out to the Church of the Eternal Source.
Yeah.
Had a very brief correspondence with them.
Wow.
I had already made offerings to Ptah. And yeah. So that caused me to do it again in Baltimore because I was at college then.
Right.
And that continued for a short period, but college got in the way. You know, life of it as a kid got in the way.
Oh yeah.
And so it faded. And this was like a pattern for me. It would come and it would go. It would fade in and fade out. And that, the final fade in, if I want to say it like that, started in probably 2008 or 2009. And I started reawakening my Egyptian studies, started redoing the grammars, doing new grammars. It might've been even earlier than 2008, come to think of it. It was more like 2002 that I started doing the grammars. And or 2004 at the very latest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was reawakening my knowledge, not so much doing cultic practices yet, but I was edging towards it with some experimentation in other types of, you might call it paganism or folk magic or whatever. And I was kind of exploring certain kinds of roots that had been there when I was a young teenager, and I was kind of returning to them. I was drawn back.
Yeah.
And then when I moved to San Francisco, that's when I got introduced to the Temple of Ra.
Nice.
And actually joined, you know, started my process of joining, because it takes a while, in 2012.
Okay.
And it could have been a bit earlier than that, but Rich had a family emergency that took all of his time for months.
Oh, man.
And everything ended up being fine. Ended up being fine. But he was visiting someone at the hospital every single day. And so he couldn't reach back out to me.
Yeah.
But then when that all stabilized, he did. And then I started the process of joining the Temple of Ra. And it's been that way ever since.
When you talk about the process of joining, is what does that involve? Is it initiatory? Is it, you know, a gradual getting to know you type of thing? How did that transpire?
That's a good question. We do not have initiatory degrees. That's not something we do.
Mm-hmm.
Any member is considered to be a servant priest or servant priestess.
Mm-hmm.
For people who know Egyptian, that's Hem Netcher or Ham Netcher, or as it comes down into Coptic, Hunt. Which is still used as one of the kinds of priest. Coptic actually has two kinds of priest names still preserved. The other one is Wa'ab, which is now Wa'ib.
Wow.
or web, kind of hard to say. But our process of discernment, or you know, probation, or whatever you want to say it. In my day, Rich would meet with me. We met personally together.
Mm-hmm.
He would give me things to read. Thing I had to write reviews, and my you could say that my graduation piece was to actually myself do an adaptation of the general. Our general ritual format for a particular god or goddess. And I did Ptah. So if you look at the latest book, Everlasting Egypt, the ritual for Ptah is one that I did as my piece that was the final part of the process of becoming a member.
Oh, that's awesome.
And not everybody comes in this way, but there is a period of at least some months.
Uh-huh.
It could be longer. Our latest person who just joined Temple of Ra, it took well over a year for us to get this done. But that, it wasn't for lack of interest so much as the way time worked for everybody.
Yeah.
And the person began to be more participative before they became a formal member, before they did the final part of becoming a member. There is a ceremony that's done in the context of a general ritual.
Mm-hmm.
There's a segment that's given over for magical action or meditation or other things, festival rites sometimes.
Yeah,
and we put the vowels there, and it's a vowels. People make a very very simple set of vowels. Basically, it means the only vowel that I would say would be restrictive is just to keep temple business private. But there's no overarching sense of secrets.
Mm-hmm.
Rich always was passionate about making this stuff public completely. About the only things we don't make public are the more privately oriented healing stuff and and sometimes magical stuff that we do.
Yeah.
We don't generally publish that broadly for a few reasons. It's too easy to misunderstand some of it.
Sure.
And sometimes, if we were to broadcast a full ritual and we're doing these things, it would expose people's private lives, and we have to be very careful about that.
Right. Well, and the Rich you're talking about is Richard Reedy. And if I'm not mistaken, he was the founder of Temple of Ra, as well as the author of one of my most beloved books, Eternal Egypt, and the following book, Everlasting Egypt, which you also had a great hand in. And maybe you could talk a little bit about Richard Reedy.
Sure. Rich was the founder of our family of temples, the Kemetic Temple Collective family. Some of the temples, actually Denver Temple, didn't start because he founded them. They started under his guidance.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an act of particularly two individuals who really learned and then founded that most distant so far of our groups. And Rich was a person who came to Kemeticism later in life himself. Mm-hmm. He was raised Russian Orthodox.
Wow.
For people who want to know, it's in the OCA, the Orthodox Church of America.
Okay.
Which is one of the versions of organizations for Russian Orthodoxy in the United States. There are three major ones and more. He actually started divinity school. He did He went to divinity school for Russian Orthodoxy.
Wow.
But he, for whatever reason, he did not complete that process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know why. I'm not sure if that would or would not have led to priesthood. I'm not sure. I just don't know how that works in that tradition. But he stayed very, very active and had positions of some responsibility inside the financial arm of the OCA.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was a change. He himself had a moment with some statues of Sekhmet. It was at the, I believe it was the British Museum. It might have been the Louvre.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually the Louvre, the British, and the Metropolitan Museum all have multiple statues of Sekhmet from this same group.
Wow.
And they're very, very well preserved. Those examples are very good ones. Mm-hmm. And I know that he had some connection happen there. There's more to it than that, and I can't speak for him, obviously. There was also more background in what was going on in pagan San Francisco at the time. He had moved from the East Coast to San Francisco.
Okay.
And that was when he started working first in a general pagan sort of context.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually he became attracted to, or was attracted to by the gods and goddesses, the comedic ways.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with Kerry Wisner and was influenced by Kerry Wisner's work,
mm-hmm.
who wrote a number of good books. We can link to those if people want to know them. Some of them are hard to find right now, but I think they'll start to be made available again.
Yeah, well, they're on Lulu. So as long as people know to go to lulu.com, they can find the three comedic books on Lulu.
Yeah, the three major ones. There's actually a few more pieces. If you look at the references in the backs of those books, refer to other things that aren't out yet again.
Okay.
Or were never really formally published. So, but anyway, let's not go there. That's a detail. And he began adapting and writing rituals for mm-hmm. a smaller group of people who ended up becoming the core of the Temple of Ra. One of the founding members is still with us.
Wow. Just one.
Mostly the others have moved away. Rich himself passed away in late 2015. So mm-hmm. he published Eternal Egypt in 2010.
Yes.
That was the first book that was widely publicly available that gave ancient Egyptian rituals that attempted to be based entirely on ancient Egyptian sources.
Right.
So there's no mixture of, now I'm gonna put a little asterisk there. There's almost no mixture of more ordinary Western concepts in there.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tiny exception to that in the way we do our the purification of a temple before each ritual. Because that's done to the four directions.
Yes.
But it's done in a way that's done from the Egyptian order of the four directions, which is south, then north, then west, then east.
Interesting.
It forms a cross. A
cross, yeah.
Which for people who know African stuff, it's sort of like the cosmodiagrams of the Congo region.
Right. And it is, and just so everybody knows, it's also not just it's noted in the book that this was written for this purpose. And I think in the book, because many times our shrines are in living spaces.
Correct. That's exactly why he did it. Yeah. And that makes perfect sense. It is actually, there is resonance to this. There is a part of the daily temple statue ritual, which involves purifying the image by walking around it four times with dry natron and dry incense. And I think you also sprinkle water also. It depends on which part you're talking about. So circumambulations were also difficult to do generally the way most people will set up their shrines.
Yeah.
Because they will tend to be against a wall.
Right.
And so we modulate that to make it towards the four directions. But the four directions are seen more broadly. You basically you draw an arc so that it really ends up getting the whole space all the way around.
Yeah.
But you don't make a circle, you make four arcs.
Yes. I was just going to say the way that I did that is instead of walking a straight line from south to north, if you do it in a curved line and then a curved line to the next direction and the next direction, it almost looks like four leaves of a plant or something like that.
Something like that. And so that's roughly what we do. So you end up having circumambulated the space, if not around the image, and you end up having literally bits of natron spread around your living room or whatever, and little bits of water that has actually had natron put into it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't in our own rituals at this point do that with frankincense or incense. I have done that actually at Karnak, just if you want to know.
Oh, wow.
But that was part of a very special one-time thing, which was actually...
We're going to have to talk about that.
Yeah, and I should probably leave that alone, except to say that was basically done specifically for Rich after his death. And it was related to connecting him back there.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it was not anything anybody can really read about. But all I want to say is that it was a very brief ritual. It was done by me, and it was facilitated by my Egyptian guide, who was absolutely wonderful, a pious Muslim man who stood respectfully right beside us as we did this.
Wow.
And one other person witnessed and took a few pictures. But he had made sure that there were no guards, nobody bothered us. And it was something that he, as soon as I told him, I realized I could not do that surreptitiously. It would just not work. And so I told him what I needed to do. And he said, "Oh, Matthew, we know what this is. We call this a Talsiya Wagiba. Talsiya means a substitution, sort of, in place of. And Wagiba means mandatory."
Wow.
It means when someone, if you're Muslim and your father can't make the Hajj, and if you just do it on his behalf after his death, that is Talsiya.
Wow.
You have actually done it on his behalf. If he asks you before he dies, because part of what I had to do was something Rich asked me to do before he died. It becomes wagaba, it becomes obligatory. So he actually had a framework to put what I was doing, and he respected it as an appropriate religious response for a friend who had died, an elder who had died. So I So I wanted people to hear that the Egyptians are perhaps more respectful of these things than people may be aware.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's respect that's required in return, of course.
Absolutely.
And one can't simply do anything. But I'm sorry I got off on that tangent.
No, that's great. That was great to hear.
But Rich, this was a little bit about Rich and explain something about him. So he wrote Eternal Egypt. We do certain things. Almost everything comes from, as I said, the 19th to 22nd dynasty temple ritual texts,
mm-hmm.
Which are found in papyri and in a couple of temple buildings. And then there are a few places that have portions that are actually deeply from the pyramid texts, like part of the incense offering is basically lifted from one of the pyramid texts.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it wasn't only used there. They would tend to get used elsewhere.
Sure.
And it turns out that the text from which the four directions purifications occur in our rituals,
mm-hmm.
actually does come from an Egyptian temple. It's just a Greco-Roman temple. I think it's from Dendera. And I'll eventually get to explaining that on my blog in detail. The relationships, what's there, how it was transformed. Because Rich did some very creative transformations, bridges between our practices today and what was done in ancient times.
Yeah.
We don't have the personnel to do the extremely elaborate full temple statue and temple offering rituals that were done every day.
Yeah.
In some form or other. Probably not always super elaborate. Sometimes in smaller temples they were done less elaborately, right? But for the same reasons we can't do them fully. But those basically are about 120 different ritual actions.
Wow.
And or offerings. So each with words.
Yeah. So the beautiful thing about in the book as well is Richard makes it quite clear that do what you can. You fit this into your life how you can. And with so much imprint in the books, it's a lot to choose from. And you can you know, he gives examples of the general ritual, shorter rituals, and a brief ritual. And you can use those as examples. And if there's something that you love and want to say every day, you can say that. But the point is to fit it into our modern life, because this is not ancient Egypt. We are not professional priests or anything. But there's so much material in Eternal Egypt and Everlasting Egypt that you could adapt it to your life beautifully, and no matter what your life entails.
Yes, and actually that's like a really great point. I wanted to actually talk about that a little bit. So let me give you a brief précis on the two books. Eternal Egypt does exactly what you said. Plus, it offers a few other kinds of rituals,
mm-hmm.
That are like we have the Sa'ahu rituals, which are the literally it means to make into an Ah, or to make effective. An Ah is a state that a person achieves after death.
Mm-hmm.
In which they are, at most fundamental, they are effective in a mysterious way. I mean, I have to say it that way. It's kind of hard to get this concept. It is not a Western concept. It is not anything like a Western concept.
Okay.
It's those people who are honored, and they're honored ancestors. They're ancestors who, or your deceased, blessed dead, who they need to have been in life, you know, people who were respected, you know, looked up to in general. Mm-hmm. They were people who behaved well, who lived a good life. They weren't criminals. You know, they weren't bad guys. They weren't debauched. They were people that could be respected. And as part of their, after a person is buried, goes through the judgments, becomes justified or true of voice, there is a state where all that goes together and the person is effectively becomes an ach. And there are a lot of texts that are called sa'ach, and that means to make into an ach. It can be translated other ways, it's fine. People might translate that as the transfiguration spells, because in a way it's achieving a new status. It's a status that is remarkably like a god, but it's not a big god. It's not a god who receives temple worship. But an ach is someone who can advocate for you in the courts of the underworld. And that has effect on real life. Mm-hmm. So if there's a dispute in your community and your neighbor isn't giving the cow back that they only borrowed or rented and they refuse to give it back, these things happen. It sort of was known that what would happen is you would petition your ancestors and they would probably petition theirs to go get a court decision done in the Duat for you.
Wow.
To get this worked out.
Yeah.
Now you could also do that in real world courts on the ground, and in many cases those also have sacred components because there are divinations involved and there can be also oaths to the gods and goddesses. Mm-hmm. Involved. So we have records of these kinds of things. So there's sa'ahu texts. They're very, all I can say is after Rich died and we performed the sa'ahu for him,
yeah,
after about 70 days at Pentheacon, at an open ritual, which was for Hathor, who receives us when we enter the Western Valley, gives us our first drink, our first food. She's the lady of the sycamore there.
Mm-hmm.
And when we did that section, none of us got through our sections to say. It's something to read these texts from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another to read them when you're doing this practice for someone you know, respect, love, or friends with.
Yeah.
They are actually rather beautiful and they are impactful. Mm-hmm. And they are emotional. And I think that that's often missing from people's understanding of Egyptian texts. Yeah. They can be awfully foreign. And that is true. When you start to get the pieces together that and start to understand the concepts and the references better, you'll see that there's actually more and more content that is extremely relatable. Now, I'm going to pivot back now to something you were talking about doing the things you can do in a ritual. Mm-hmm. And Eternal Egypt has more of that. I'm going to get in a moment to what Everlasting Egypt is in a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.